Dr. Ron Carlson, president of Christian Ministries International, has traveled and spoken in 78 countries on 6 continents. He's a recognized authority on world religions, non-Christian cults, and Christian apologetics. This tape is entitled Fossils, Dinosaurs, and Geology.
Well, it's great. I'm looking forward to tonight as we deal with the question of fossils, dinosaurs, geology, and the age of the earth. I was invited a couple of years ago to speak at the University of Minnesota in a class that a friend of mine was taking. The class was entitled, and it was a class designed for senior biology students who were honor students in biology. And it was kind of the last course they wanted them to take as they left the University of Minnesota. And the course was entitled, What Every Evolutionist Should Know About Scientific Creationism. And it was a course designed to try and tear down the creationist position and to elevate evolution as the supreme teaching. And I had a friend of mine who was taking the class, and he asked his professor, he said, do you think it'd be okay if, at the end of the class, so one of the last classes, we invited in a Baptist preacher I know, and just have him kind of present what the biblical position is on creation. Well, when he told the professor that he could bring in a Baptist preacher, talking about me, the professor started salivating at the mouth and thought this would be great. And after he had prepared the students for a semester, they'd bring me in and tear me apart, and evolution would win. So they arranged for me to come in, and it was a three-hour course once a week. And the professor said, we'll give you an hour and a half to lecture, but we want an hour and a half to ask you questions. And when I got to the course, there are about 40 honor biology students sitting around a table, and they were salivating. They couldn't wait to, they had been all prepared by the professor. One of the most amazing things, I would have given anything to have a video of what took place that day. Because one of the most amazing things happened. As I began to lecture, you could see the students. I mean, they were just ready to rip into me. And as I started explaining the scientific evidence for creation and why evolution did not have a leg to stand on scientifically, you could see the anger in the students over the hour and a half gradually move from me towards their professor. And so what happened was, when I opened it up for questions, the first questions were not to me, but were to the professor. And these honor biology students, they said to the professor, how come we have been at this university for 4 years and nobody has told us the truth? And they were angry at the professor. And they started going after the professor. And after an hour and a half of answering all their questions, as soon as the 3 hours was up, the professor, man, his veins were sticking out. He was turning red. He just hightailed it out of the class. The students stayed for another 2 hours asking me questions. We had a wonderful time. And but I came back to that question that I asked you this morning. You know, it's a very interesting question to ask an evolutionist. You know, can you name me just one thing that you know is scientifically true about evolution? If you're here tonight and you believe in evolution, can you just name me one thing that you know is scientifically true about evolution? Is it true that life comes from non-living matter, as evolution claims? No, the law of biogenesis. Life only comes from life. It does not come from non-living matter. Does that more logically, rationally, and scientifically fit evolution, or does it more logically, rationally, and scientifically fit creation? Do things evolve to greater and greater complexity and organization all by chance, as evolution claims? No, the second law of thermodynamics, entropy, everything's going in the opposite direction. Do we find, as Darwin said, millions of transitional fossils, which he said had to be in the fossil record if evolution is true? No, we have yet to find one transitional fossil. Well, just name me one thing that you know is scientifically true about evolution. You know, I've been asking that question around the world. I have yet to get an answer. But many students, you know, they've never been presented with the truth. People say, well, wait a minute, Carlson. You know, you present this evidence, but what about all the supposed monkey men? You know, what about all these monkey men we've heard about? Time magazine a while back had a very interesting cover story entitled How Man Became Man. And on the cover, they had a picture of Richard Leakey, a paleontologist in Kenya, and Homo habilis, one of our alleged pre-ancestors. And Leakey is the one over here. How Man Became Man. It's very interesting. In this Time magazine, Time magazine had a very interesting advertisement for their Time Life book series entitled The Emergence of Man. Now, this book series by Time Life is now found in virtually every public school and library in our country. The advertisement says, begin with the missing link, yours to enjoy free for 10 days. You can have them running around your school or something. But let me read for you. Let me just read the first paragraph as to what Time magazine says you're going to learn about evolution. I quote Time magazine. Today, that creature who first ventured to raise himself above the other animals no longer exists. He has become you. Unique, set apart from the 2 million other species living on a planet, by a thumb that makes your hand a precision tool, by a knee that locks you into a comfortable upright position, and by your capacity for abstract thought and speech. All this and more has enabled your species to dominate the earth. And yet, you share with every other creature that ever lived the same origin. Now get this. You share with every other creature that ever lived the same origin. The same accident that led to the spontaneous creation of the first single-cell slimy algae 3.5 billion years ago. Isn't that exciting to know tonight? You all share the same accident? You've all evolved out of the same slimy algae 3.5 billion years ago. I just want you to stop and think about that for a moment. Understand this has become the basis of education in most universities in this country. That there is no God, man is simply an accident evolved from slimy algae. You know, if you believe that, you have to ask some basic questions, like number one, what does that do to the value of human life? What value do you have as an individual if you're nothing but an accident evolved from slimy algae? What does it do to the basis of morality? What basis of morals do you have if you're nothing but an accident evolved out of slimy algae? What does it do to the meaning and purpose of life? Time magazine goes on. How did it all happen? What was the evolutionary process that led to man and his conquest of a harsh and hostile environment? You'll find the amazing story in Time Life Book's new series, The Emergence of Man. Your introductory volume, The Missing Link, shows you the stranger than science fiction world. Boy, that's an understatement. Stranger than science fiction world of Australopithecus the ape man. You'll feel a sense of immediacy and visual adventure in the incredible lifelike pictorial technique, photo painting. It's amazing how many students will see pictures of these things in their textbooks and go, wow, they must be real. They got pictures of them. Photo painting. Artists' renditions of a philosophical concept. Well, what about all these supposed monkey men? It's very interesting. My son, who's a junior in college, 2 summers ago, we went to the British Museum of Natural History in London, England. The British Museum of Natural History is the largest museum in the world on evolution. And when you walk into the museum, they have this big display entitled Our Living Relatives. And then down at the bottom it says, we belong to the ape family. Our living relatives. Well, I had to get my picture taken with all my relatives. And I am the one over on this side. Our living relatives. But it shows you what has happened in our society. How our universities, our museums are constantly trying to convince us that we're nothing but animals. We're just evolved apes. You probably saw the newspaper this week. This is from Thursday's paper this last week, the Fresno Bee. Life's a real zoo for day and each couple. Thursday's newspaper said that in Copenhagen, the zoo has added an exhibit of Homo sapiens because they want all the animals in the zoo. So they got chimpanzees, orangutans, gorillas, and now Homo sapiens. and they got two people living in a plexiglass cage so that people can observe the animal Homo sapiens, humans. Well, what about all the supposed monkey men? Do you recognize anybody up there? I was taking a course going to Cal State Hayward here in California. I was living in Walnut Creek and attended Cal State Hayward for a year. One of the courses that I took there was a course in physical anthropology, which is the study of human evolution. Now, I'll never forget the first day of class, I walked into my professor's office, and I noticed that she had this hanging on her bulletin board over her desk. And it just kind of caught my fancy, and I just started chuckling a little bit, you know? And the professor said to me, she said, "What's so funny?" I said, "Look at Professor," I said, "somebody stuck this up on your bulletin board." She said, "What do you mean?" She says, "I put it up there." I said, "Come on, Professor." I said, "Nobody believes that anymore." She said, "What do you mean? Of course we believe it. That's what the course is about." I said, "Come on, Professor." I said, "You know that's a nice 19th century theory totally destroyed by 20th century science." Well, that was the first day of class. We had a wonderful semester together. It's very interesting what we find as you go through the famous chart of the monkey men. We had first had the famous Pithecanthropus erectus found by Dr. Du Bois down in Indonesia. What Dr. Du Bois had found was two teeth according to the Americans. The British say he found three teeth, part of a jawbone, part of a thigh bone. From this he put together the famous Pithecanthropus erectus, was in our textbooks for 40 years as the missing link. It wasn't until 40 years later that National Geographic Society, in investigating the famous Pithecanthropus, discovered that at the same geological strata that Dr. Du Bois had found the two teeth or three teeth, if you're British, jawbone and a thigh bone, that he had also found two complete human skeletons the same as modern-day Aborigines. He had buried those two complete skeletons in a chest for 40 years because they did not fit his philosophical assumption of evolution. It wasn't until National Geographic exposed what he'd actually found that Dr. Du Bois admitted that the two teeth or three teeth, jawbone and thigh bone, were actually that of a modern-day gibbon, a monkey. Well, we also had found down in Indonesia the famous Java man. It was interesting. Newsweek magazine, January 1988, had a famous cover story entitled "The Search for Adam and Eve on Human Origins." And in this article, they say that two best evidences we have today for human evolution are Java man and Peking man. Java man and Peking man, who are in all of our textbooks, dated 500 to 600,000 years old. And I went to see Java man. He's in the museum in Amsterdam. He sends his greetings. And but consider the best evidence we have, they say, for human evolution. It's fascinating if you understand Java man. Found down in Indonesia. It is a skeleton that was put together from bones they found scattered over a 26-mile area of riverbed. I mean, it's a regular human tinker toy factory down there. I submit to anyone, first of all, it's highly unscientific to put together a skeleton from bones scattered over a 26-mile area of riverbed. What's even more interesting is 2 years after they put it together, some zoologists in investigating it discovered that the top of the cranium, the skull cap, was actually an elephant's kneecap. They literally had to throw it away, get another skull cap to put on Java man. He's still being listed as the best evidence we have today for human evolution. They also list Peking man in here. I've been asking students for the last 15 years to show me any evidence of Peking man. He's in all of our textbooks, dated 500,000 years old. You ever seen Peking man? They got artists' drawings, photo painting in our textbooks. Two GIs during the Second World War in Peking, China, said that they found a shoebox with some bones in it. That's Peking man. There's one problem, though. During the war, the shoebox got lost. Nobody knows where the bones are today. Nobody knows where the two GIs are who found the shoebox with the bones in it. It's still being listed today as the best evidence we have today for human evolution. You know, it's like that old Wendy's commercial. Remember, where's the beef? No, where's the beef? You want me to believe evolution? Where's the beef? Where's the evidence? Well, of course, we then had the famous Piltdown man. For 40 years, he was in our textbooks as the missing link. And Piltdown, for years, was declared to be clearly transitional form. They found Piltdown south of London, England, in Piltdown, England, found by the head of the British Museum of Natural History. It wasn't until 1980 that Nature magazine, the leading science journal out of Great Britain, had a very interesting article entitled Piltdown Man Hoax Verified. Let me just read part of it. An eminent geologist who wanted to deceive a bitter professional rival invented the Piltdown Man fraud, in which a fake prehistoric skull fooled the world for four decades. A tape recording by an eight scientist now dead pins the hoax on Professor William Solis, professor of geology at Oxford University. The victim was Sir Arthur Smith Woodward, keeper of geology at the British Museum, with whom Solis had feuded. Smith Woodward proclaimed the discovery genuine, as did many distinguished scientists from around the world, and died believing it genuine. Now, the article by Dr. Beverly Halstead, who's professor of zoology and geology at Reading University in England, they ask her, why did Solis never expose the fraud to humiliate his rival? She says, quote, I believe he felt unable to reveal the hoax when he saw all the other eminent scientists who joined with Smith Woodward in authenticating the find. Now we discover what actually took place. The head of geology at Oxford University in England had been in a rivalry with the head of the British Museum. The head of the British Museum was excavating in Piltdown, England, and so the professor at Oxford, with some of his students, they had taken a human skull, they attached an orangutan jaw, they chemically dyed it with iron salts to make it look old, they filed down the molar teeth, and they buried it in a hill where the guy was digging. Well, the next day, the head of the British Museum's out there, and he's digging away. Guess what he discovers? He discovers this skull with an ape jawbone. Scientists fly in from around the world. They all declare it genuine. The missing link, finally we find transitional form between ape and man. For 40 years it was in our textbooks. We now know it as the Great Piltdown Hoax. Come to find out the reason they never exposed the hoax for 40 years is they did not want to embarrass all the eminent scientists who agreed it must be genuine. Now that most of them have died, we discover what actually took place. Well, students often say, well, wait a minute, Carlson. You know, what about the famous people? I mean, what about people like Dr. Lewis Leakey? Dr. L.S.B. Leakey excavated an Olduvai Gorge, Tanzania. What did Leakey find? Well, you know, Leakey, he was quite a character. He shook up a lot of people back in the mid-60s. Excavating Olduvai Gorge, he discovered what he called Zinjanthropus, means earliest man. He went and dated at 1.2 million years old. Now, that shook up a lot of people because up to that time, the earliest supposed monkey man had been dated around 800,000 years old. Along comes Leakey, he finds Zinjanthropus, earliest man, he dates at 400,000 years before the earliest monkey man. Well, that wasn't so bad. In 1972, his son, Richard Leakey, who's now the curator of the Nairobi Museum, he was excavating Lake Turkana, Kenya. He discovered the famous Australopithecus africanus, which has been renamed Homo habilis. He went and dated it 2.2 million years old. Well, that wasn't so bad. The next year, his mother, Mary Leakey, wife of L.S.B. Leakey, she was excavating Lake Turkana, Kenya, and she discovered in 1973 the famous genus Homo, first man. You know what she did in 1973? She went and dated it 3.2 million years old. Well, what are you doing with humans 2.5 million years before the earliest monkey man? That wasn't so bad. The next year, in 1974, Dr. Donald Johansson of Case Western Reserve, who is now at the University of California, Berkeley, Dr. Donald Johansson was excavating in the Afar Valley of Ethiopia. And he discovered the famous Australopithecus afarensis, which has been renamed Lucy and the family. And they called it Lucy because they were listening to the Beatles album, Lucy's Diamonds in the Sky. And Johansson, in 1974, went and dated it 4 million years old. And you've probably seen pictures of Lucy. It's the most famous find today. It's been written up in all the science journals and Reader's Digest. And I should have blown the picture up, but Lucy is a skull that has this heavy gorilla ape crest, a heavy brow crest on the forehead. I saw Johansson a couple of years ago being interviewed on the Dick Cavett Show late one night, and he had on this famous skull of Lucy, 4 million years old. And halfway through the program, I'll never forget, Dick Cavett was looking at the skull, and he said to Johansson, he said, "What are these white spots on the back of the cranium here?" And Johansson sank down in his seat a little bit. He said, "Well, those are the chips of bone we found." And Dick Cavett said, "What?" He said, "Well, those are the chips of bone we found." And Dick Cavett said, "You mean you didn't find this whole skull? Pictured in all the magazines and Reader's Digest and all the books?" He said, "Well, not exactly. We found these chips of bone back here." Now, nowhere in any of the science journals does he tell you this. They make you assume they found the whole skull. Well, Dick Cavett asked him, he says, "Well, if you only found these chips of bone back here, what's the rest of the skull?" And Johansson said, "Well, it's plaster Paris chemically dyed to look like a skull." And Dick Cavett then asked him, he says, "Well, if you only found these chips of bone back here, how do you know it had a heavy gorilla ape crest on the forehead?" Johansson gave the most incredible answer live on TV. He said, quote, he said, "Well, obviously evolution occurred. And since evolution obviously occurred, it must have had a gorilla ape crest on the forehead. Don't bother me with the facts. Let me just hold to my biased presupposition." Well, then Dick Cavett asked him, he said, "Well, was there any evidence for how Lucy and the family died?" And the family is this partial skeleton that he says was put together from 13 different individuals. He said he took 13 individuals, just lumped them into one skeleton, and calls it the family. Sounds scientific to me. And he said, "Was there any evidence how they died?" And Johansson said, "Well, it was obvious that they had been buried by a massive flood." And Dick Cavett said, "Well, could that have been the flood of Noah?" And I'll never forget Johansson's reaction. He said, well, obviously that never happened. Don't bother me with the facts. Let me just hold to my biased presupposition." He then asked Johansson this question. He said, "Well, how did you date it 4 million years old?" This was his answer live on TV. He said, "Well, when we flew over the Afar Valley in Ethiopia," he said, "when I looked down from the airplane," he said, "I could tell that anything we found down there would be 3.5 to 4 million years old. I'm just glad they didn't drop a Dixie cup out the window." I'll never forget watching television in 1974. I was watching John Chancellor on NBC News when he first announced the discovery of Lucy and the family. And NBC News, I'll never forget, announced that they had dated it 4 million years based upon carbon-14 dating. Well, I was rolling on the floor laughing. I mean, either NBC News didn't have the foggiest idea what they were talking about, or they simply lying to the public. I spent a year studying archaeology in Israel, and in archaeology, we use carbon-14 dating all the time. And even Dr. Willard Libby, who won the Nobel Prize for discovering carbon-14 dating in 1950, even he will tell you the half-life is too short, that you can only date something with carbon-14 back to 5,000 to 6,000 years at most. In fact, in archaeology, most archaeologists won't use it beyond 2,000 to 3,000 years because there's such a high degree of variability, and then we'll only use it if we can cross-date it with another historical method. The reason being, for example, we used to take these mollusk shells. They're like barnacles out of the Mediterranean. And every time you date a mollusk shell with carbon-14 dating, you always come up with dates that it's been dead 2,000 to 2,500 years, when in fact it's still alive. So there are some basic problems with carbon-14 dating. And in that case, any secular scientist will tell you the problem is the leaching of limestone in the Mediterranean that completely throws off the carbon-14 dating. But carbon-14 dating, you can only date things that were once alive with it, and it only goes back few thousand years. Most people won't use it beyond 2 to 3, 5 to 6, according to Willard Libby, who won the Nobel Prize. Well, people say, well, how are they dating these things then? You know, how do you date bones? 1 million years old, or 2 million, or 4 million years old? How are they dating them? Well, you cannot date a bone or a tooth radiometrically, because they're porous material. So how do you date fossils? And understand, folks, they're not finding museums full of these monkey men. What they're finding are chips of bone or teeth. And with plaster Paris, they're building plaster Paris heads, plaster Paris bodies, taping hair to them, building whole societies and civilizations around a tooth or a chip of bone. You say, well, how do you date them? Well, in paleontology, which is the study of fossils, what you do is when you go out into the field and you begin to excavate down through the geological strata, okay, as you dig down through the dirt, when you find a chip of bone or tooth, how do you know how old it is? Well, what you will do is you will date the age of that bone, that fossil, based upon the age of the geological strata it is found in. Okay? Well, people say, well, how then do you date the geological strata? Well, it's very simple. You date the geological strata based upon the age of the fossil. Now, the first time I heard this at the university, I wasn't sure I was hearing right. You date the fossil by the geological strata and the geological strata by the fossil. Sounds a little like circular reasoning to me. Well, this is what Discover Magazine calls the dating game. You ever play the dating game? Boy, we had some guy dating tonight. I'll tell you, that was... Congratulations. That's wonderful. You know, I'm a minister. I mean, we could do this thing right now. What about the dating game? You know, how do you date fossils? Let me show you how the game works in paleontology. If you have the World Book Encyclopedia, and every university, every college, every public library has the World Book Encyclopedia, okay? When you go home, look this up. It's very interesting. In the World Book Encyclopedia, look up fossil, okay? Under fossil in the World Book Encyclopedia, it says this. Scientists determine when fossils were formed by finding out the age of the rocks in which they lie. Okay, you find the age of the fossil based upon the age of the rock. Okay, now you turn in the World Book Encyclopedia to paleontology. Okay, paleontology. Under paleontology, it says this. Paleontology is important in the study of geology. The age of rocks may be determined by what? By the fossils in them. Folks, this is the World Book Encyclopedia, used in every university in this country. You date the fossils by the geological strata. You date the geological strata by the age of the fossil. This is the World Book Encyclopedia. Stone Age man, it says this, a mummified corpse of a late Stone Age man has provided scientists with a vivid picture of the clothing and equipment of what? 3000 BC. But the question of who he was and where he came from cannot yet be answered. They can't figure out what was this guy doing at 3000 BC, frozen solid in ice, 14,000 feet up in the Alps. When they first discovered him in 92, they first said, the anthropologist, well, he must have been buried by a glacier. And from the Ice Age. And by the way, folks, you wonder where the Ice Age and the idea of glaciation came from? If you want to read about the Ice Age, look up the name Charles Lyell. L-Y-E-L-L. You'll discover in the encyclopedia that Charles Lyell not only invented the geological column, but Charles Lyell had to explain the geological features around the world that clearly show a worldwide flood. And since he could not accept the catastrophe of the flood, because it would destroy his whole uniformitarian view of geology, Charles Lyell in the 19th century invented the idea of the ice ages and glaciation moving slowly over millions of years over the continent to try and explain the features that were clearly evidence of the worldwide flood. But when they first found this guy, they said, oh, he must have been buried by glaciation. And those who study glaciers said, well, wait a minute, glaciers move. If this guy is buried by a glacier, he would have been ripped apart. This guy is fully intact. How'd he get there? 3000 BC, I'll tell you what he was doing. He was running as fast as he could away from the flood. Let me show you something, folks. This geological column, as I said, we've never found it anywhere in the world, but even if we did find this, this is not evidence of evolution. What is this evidence of? This is evidence, folks, of a worldwide flood and everything being buried in its logical, ecological niche by a worldwide flood. If you had a worldwide flood, would not the shellfish, the trilobites, brachiopods at the ocean, bottom of the ocean be buried first? Would not the fish be buried next? Would not the amphibians along the seashore be buried next? Would not the smaller reptiles be buried next to larger reptiles? Would not the smaller mammals running up the hills be buried next? The larger ones going up be buried next? Homo sapien, like Iceman, run as fast as he can, be buried next? Folks, this is not evidence of evolution. This is evidence of a worldwide flood and everything being buried in its logical, ecological niche 5,000 years ago. What I'm saying is this, folks. If you're honest with the scientific evidence demonstrates tonight that you are not billions of years old, but that we are in fact of a very recent origin. I'll never forget speaking at the University of Virginia, and a girl came up to me after my lecture just crying. And I said, what's wrong? She said, you know, all my life, I felt like my life was so insignificant. If this world was 4.5 billion years old, she said, my life had no significance. But she said, you know, if what you're saying is true, and the scientific evidence shows that we are of a very recent origin, 6,000 years ago, she says, that means that my lifespan of 60, 70, 80 years has major significance in the history of the world. Think about that, folks. You are not an accident evolved out of slimy algae. You, in fact, are a unique creation of God. So valuable and so loved that Jesus Christ died for each and every one of you. Of a very recent origin. Wherever you explore, whether it be the macrocosms of astronomy or the microcosms of biochemistry, wherever we discover truth, folks, it's always consistent with God's Word and God's character. Folks, there is no contradiction between science and the Bible. The contradiction is between a man-made theory called evolution that has no scientific validity in the Bible, not between science and the Bible. Let's bow in a word of prayer. By the way, before we pray, can I say one more thing? A lot of Christians hold to evolution. There are a lot of Christian colleges and Christian seminaries and Christian churches and Christian pastors who teach that God used evolution to create the world. It's called theistic evolution. And a lot of people, they don't know what to do with evolution, so they say, well, we'll say God used evolution to create the world. Well, let me say this, folks. I tell people that's a nice idea if we found any evidence for evolution. The problem is we find no evidence for evolution theistically or naturalistically. Secondly, why would a perfect God use an imperfect means to create a perfect world? Understand something. Evolution requires two things. Evolution requires chance and massive death and destruction. People who hold the theistic evolution says that man started the process and then millions and millions of species died out through the survival of the fittest in order to form Homo sapiens. And when God finally got it right after billions of years, he breathed in the man the breath of life and man became a living soul. You know, theistic evolutionists believe that God used massive death and destruction to create Adam and Eve. There's one problem, folks, though. It's Romans 5:12. Romans 5:12 says there was no death prior to sin. And sin came through one man, Adam. Folks, how could you have massive death and destruction creating Adam and Eve when the Bible says there was no death prior to sin and sin came through one man, Adam? I've had professors at Christian colleges go, huh, I never thought about that one before. There's no evidence theistically or naturalistically. God spoke, and it was. People say, you believe that God did it in six 24-hour days? I say, folks, if you understand the nature of God, and you understand the omnipotence of God, that God is all-powerful, folks, God did not need six 24-hour days. He could have done it in 6 seconds, if you understand the nature of God. People who say that the days of Genesis are long periods of time, millions, billions of years old, they are people who have a very small concept of God. And they say, well, we got to help God out, you know. We got to help him out, and we'll give him lots of time to create the world. Folks, they have a very small concept of God. God did not need six 24-hour days. I do believe they were six 24-hour days. But he could have done it in 6 seconds, if you understand who God is. Let's bow in a word of prayer now. How great thou art.